Introducing the new Starbucks Pairings menu, where you can get a tall brewed coffee or tea, hot or iced, paired with a croissant starting at $5, or with a breakfast sandwich starting at $6. Because at Starbucks, we know that some things are better together. Limited time offer at participating stores. Restrictions apply. Visit starbucks.com/pairings to learn more.
Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's brand new day toilet bowl cleaner disinfects both the toilet brush and bowl, killing 99.9% of viruses and bacteria with a fragrance that feels like a tropical getaway for your senses. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
Welcome to another episode of No Script, No Problem on Believe, the number one podcast network for professionals. Do you believe? I'm your host, Steve Berkowitz. If you enjoy No Script, No Problem, please subscribe and rate the show with 5 stars. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Amazon Podcasts, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can also find it on Believe.com and at Believe Podcasts. Follow me on social media. Find me on Threads, Blue Sky, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Mastodon, or Facebook. If you're interested in advertising on the show, please contact Believe at Believe.com. All right, let's get started. Coming up on the show, I've got 2 great interviews for you. I'm talking to award-winning documentary filmmaker Sasha Jenkins about his Paramount Plus feature doc, All Up in the Biz, which chronicles the life of the late rapper Biz Markie. But before that, it's time for me to chat with author Chris Panettiere about his latest horror novel, The Redemption of Morgan Bright. Chris is a friend of mine. I met him a few years ago when he was winning millions of dollars for his clients as a civil litigator in Texas. But we are not talking about the law today. We're going to be chatting about his latest novel, The Redemption of Morgan Bright, plunges readers into the unsettling world of Hollyhock Asylum, where protagonist Morgan Bright finds herself confined after a series of traumatic events leave her with fragmented memories and a tenuous grasp on reality. As Morgan delves deeper into her past and the mysteries surrounding Hollyhock, she uncovers a disturbing truth about the asylum's history and the forces that may be manipulating her present. Woo! This is Chris's 3rd book, and he has some great advice for aspiring authors. I hope you guys really enjoy this interview. Chris Panettiere, welcome to No Script, No Problem, and congratulations on the redemption of Morgan Bright.
Hey, thanks so much, Steve, for having me, and I appreciate it.
First of all, we know each other. I'm going to tell the audience. All right, so you and I know each other. We've known each other for about 4 years. I knew you as a lawyer, an incredible lawyer. How do you go from being this great lawyer who takes up a lot of time, and you're also a dad, you know, so you're a husband, you're a dad. How do you find the time to go and you write 3 books? How does that happen?
The decision to become a writer was so weird. It makes no sense. It was 2015. I was in the thick of a huge fight where we were going after, as you know, going after different companies for asbestos in baby powder and talcum powder and makeup. We represented, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people who had a deadly form of cancer from that. And my daughter was 1 year old. My wife and I went to the movies. We saw the movie Interstellar, which just blew my head open. I just came home just like a changed person. I love that movie so much. And I thought, I want to spend more time in this world. I want to write stories about outer space. That's where it started. And at that point, I was someone who had never written anything of a creative nature outside of you know, narratives I might develop in the courtroom. And I Googled, how do you write dialogue? Like, where does the comma go? Where do the quotation marks go? And I just started writing bad fiction. And I don't know what came over me. I started doing it. I wrote every day. I have still written every day since then. That's how the journey started. And then to answer the second part of your question, how did I do it while doing all that other stuff? Well, what's interesting is when I had my daughter, the thing I realized wasn't how much less time I had, the thing I realized was, what in God's name was I doing with my time before? And
wow,
having her made me hyper focused and perhaps more organized. And yeah, and so when I found time to write, I put it to work. So I didn't mess around or whatever. I would write a little bit in the mornings, mostly in the evening after she was in bed, and she wasn't a big sleeper. So it was like a little bit until she woke up again. And on planes, I mean, one of my great treats was I would fly to go do a hearing or a deposition or a trial. And on the way out there, I'd be working and reading depositions and getting ready. And the treat for me was on the way back, on the flight back, I would write. I got my first publishing deal in 2019, which is interesting. We could talk about that too if you want. But the bottom line is that I got a publishing deal. I was then in trial in New Brunswick, New Jersey against Johnson & Johnson. We were trying a punitive damages phase against them. And I had just gotten edits back from my editor at my publisher. And I would go try the case during the day. Then we would get ready for the next day until maybe 11 o'clock at night. And then for 2 to 3 hours, I would revise. And then I would go to court in the morning. So I was working on both. I suppose I had to learn how to switch tracks very quickly. So that's how it happened. And as you know, I've stepped back a little bit from law now, so I have a little bit more time.
That's amazing that I guess I didn't realize that you really, you're completely self-taught as a writer. What was that process in terms of, like, you know, I would think at some point you realized I'm pretty good at this. How was that process of improvement? Who kind of was that person that kind of told you, hey, you got something there? Was it your wife? When was that point when you were comfortable showing what you had written to somebody?
That is a, of all loaded questions, that is the most loaded, because I don't think any writer thinks they're great or really good. Maybe there are a few, but the ones who think they're great probably haven't been writing that long and haven't developed a nice, healthy layer of self-doubt. I've only gotten to the point recently where I believe my writing is good enough to continue to be published and to, you know, have short stories published and have people want to read my stuff. It is a constant battle to write something new and go, does this suck? Did I forget how to write? And I don't think that's uncommon at all. I've heard lots of writers say that, because, you know, when you finish a book, let's say, you know, you turn in a manuscript and then you go through all these layers of edits and you get to the final and it's feeling pretty good. Well, then you send it off. It's done. And then you say, okay, what am I going to write next? And then you start writing again. And what's on that page doesn't look very good at all compared to what you just finished, because it had been through so many passes of edits and revisions and all that. So you always have to remind yourself, this is going to start off and it's going to look like shit. And then it's only going to get better as you have subsequent passes. But I had a healthy, thankfully, I had a very healthy respect for what it would take to become a writer who's traditionally published. I had no expectation of meeting that goal other than to keep trying. And the one thing I had was resilience and understanding. When I started writing, I found this blog by this agent named Janet Reed. Now, she just passed away last month, but she's a big time agent. And she had this blog. If anybody listening wants to check it out, it's Janet Reed and it's Blogspot. So you could just Google that and find it. And she was putting out, you know, a post a day or every other day about the publishing industry. And so I would sit there with my coffee in the mornings and I would read 10 or 15 of those as I was a new writer. And so I had no illusions as to what it was going to take. I knew it was going to be extremely hard to, first of all, write something, second of all, to get an agent, and then third of all, to sell, you know, to a publisher. So I had a very healthy respect for the work and the journey, and that it might just be a journey that never really ends. You know, I'm lucky to be published now, and it takes some luck. But now I want to continue publishing. So it's like starting over every time. Like I write something new and I want the next deal.
One of the things I respect so much about your writing is that I think, like, I have friends who've gotten their books published, but it's all kind of like, I'm going to tell the story of what I've been through. And I very much respect that. Or I've got advice for people. You know, I could totally see you writing about the law, writing about some of the big cases you've been in, but you decided, I want to write about horror. You know, very much completely different from your day job. What made you go, you know what? I want nothing to do with writing about the law or about cases. What inspired you to go down this very, I was about to say dark, this very kind of unique horror path as a writer?
That's a great question. It's because it's funny. So many people were like, oh, you should write legal thrillers. You should, you know, explore that. And I think the quick answer is a heavy dose of burnout that I was suffering in my career after 2 decades made me not ever want to write about the law at all. And I came to writing late. I came to reading fiction late. And only when I was in my mid-30s, and of course I read fiction throughout my life, but never like a reader, you know, people that are really reading every day. You know, I have friends who can read a book a day. I still will never read a book a day. I'm a slow reader. You know, I can manage a book a week if I'm really trying. Most of the time I may be a book and a half a month or something like that. And so when I started reading fiction, like genre fiction, and it started with science fiction, some fantasy, the book that really kickstarted, two books really kickstarted it for me. The first was, and I kind of have my daughter to thank for so much of this, who's now 10. The first one was, while before she was born, we were trying to work on names, and my wife, who is a big reader, very big reader, always has been a big reader, she suggested Lyra. And Lyra is, of course, the protagonist of His Dark Materials, the trilogy by Philip Pullman. And I was like, okay, well, I love that name, but I want to go meet this person, right? And I wasn't reading a bunch. I had read all of the Song of Ice and Fire, all of that stuff, mainly for my wife, because we were going to watch the show. So I was like, okay, I'll read the book so we can talk about this stuff. And I really enjoyed it. And then I read His Dark Materials. And that blew my mind in such, people will laugh. It's so naive. But I was like, wow, books are amazing, guys. I don't know if you guys know this, right? I mean, I was so... I spent my whole adult life reading nonfiction stuff, a lot of science. I'm really into astrophysics and astronomy and all of that. And I have applied that in some of my writing. But this was the first time my mind was really blown open. And kind of from there, I was like, I want to play in this world. I want to play in pure imagination, creating things from whole cloth. And I was way more interested in that than doing more of what I was doing in my day job. And so I wanted to create entirely what felt to me like entirely original stories. There's no such thing anymore, of course, but there's original takes on old stories. And I think I was doing a lot of that.
All right. So let's talk about the redemption of Morgan Bright. All right. The story revolves around, as the title suggests, Morgan Bright. She blames herself for her sister's death. Her sister died on the road leading away from Hollyhock Asylum. Unknown reasons, as always, in a good book. The case is still unsolved a year later. So Morgan creates a false identity and goes inside the asylum. She quickly discovers, yeah, this is not good. This place is messed up. You got all kinds of supernatural stuff. You got ghosts and kind of chaos ensues. All right. So first question, like the asylum is just like the coolest place for a horror story. What was kind of the inspiration for Hollyhock? How did you kind of bring Hollyhock to life? And it becomes kind of a character unto itself.
No doubt. I wanted to write an asylum story that was like a contemporary Gothic. So this is a contemporary story. And so I wanted some old asylum aesthetics because readers love that, but in a contemporary setting. So of course this particular, and of course they would balk if you called it an asylum. It was an asylum, and now it's a very kind of, it sells itself as an enlightened, upscale, almost luxury hospital for women's mental health. But, you know, looks can be deceiving. And throughout the journey of the story, you realize kind of the truth about Hollyhock. It is a very old building in actuality. It's gone through several different iterations. This is only just the most recent. And it may also be built on poisoned land, so to speak, making Hollyhock a bit of an amplifier for whatever is going on there. And I think some of the main influences, there were no asylum story influences that I had going into this. The only influence I had regarding that was the true story of Nellie Bly, the 23-year-old journalist who in 1887 had herself committed to New York State Asylum, which is the moxie to do something like that as a woman in the late 1800s is just unfathomable to me. She did it. She was there for 10 days. They tried to keep her there, and her editor had to go and get her out, and she wrote a book called 10 Days in a Madhouse in order to report on the conditions of the patients. So that was the real life inspiration. In terms of influences that I think shaped how I wanted to paint this place, I wanted it to be very different than anything anyone had seen in terms of an asylum, yet lay the proper groundwork, the proper breadcrumbs, if you will, that are familiar enough to people to where they say, oh, like I know this. I know where we're going generally. Yes, this is what I wanted from my asylum story, even though the asylum is quite different. And I think I took aesthetic clues from movies, actually, like Midsommar, The Road to Wellville. I think that's what it's called. And even Hereditary, the house that Hereditary is centered on, that house is actually, what I loved about that movie is that house is a very nice, very cozy, warm house. It should be for all effects and purposes. And the way it was shot really turned that on its head and made it absolutely nerve shredding, and terrifying. And so I took clues from movies for visual purposes that were familiar, but took a setting that maybe shouldn't have been scary or terrifying or one where you would set horror and made it that way. I mean, Midsommar is a great example. I mean, it's all filmed during the day, you know, and to me, I love that movie. It was a trip. I was cackling with joy as I was watching Midsommar, even though there were some just utterly terrifying bits to it. So I wanted to give readers something familiar, but also something new that made you think a little bit before you turn the page.
Midsommar was like, to me, there was something so utterly terrifying about that. Like the kind of cold, dead eyes of everyone in the cult, like just freaked me out, like so freaked me out. And like being the jumping off of the being thrown off of the cliff, just, oh, everything about it freaked me out. Totally freaked me out.
Yeah. And there, me too. Me too. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about kind of the development of Morgan's character, because as using kind of the false identity, you know, you were kind of playing back and forth between the development, you know, of two characters. Tell me a little bit about how you kind of wanted to develop her character over the course of the novel.
That's another great question, because it does go sideways for her in this book. And for me, when I begin drafting to me is a process of discovery. I tend to write from the seat of my pants. I have an idea about where the story is going to go, but I don't outline unless I'm very deep in the story. I know what's going to happen now. I kind of have the beats set up in my mind and I need to just see it on paper. But generally I don't set out an outline, because that kind of, for me personally, that kind of takes some of the creative juice. So I tend to do things by the seat of my pants. And initially, look, the story is a woman assumes a false identity. She goes into this place to try to find out why her sister died. And that's how I started writing it. It was Morgan, the main character, playing an alter ego of Charlotte Turner. And that is how it started. Pretty quickly, however, I don't remember making the decision to have Charlotte start to become real, but she did. And, you know, any writer of any media will tell you that when you write characters, sometimes it's, you know, it's coming from your own subconscious or whatever, but sometimes those characters start to behave on their own. And when they do, sometimes amazing things happen. And here it set up really the whole story. It set up the whole crux of the story, that this mask that Morgan had created for herself decided it didn't just want to be a mask. And this means that they are then led into sort of a battle for primacy over Morgan's body, which autonomy and identity were themes that I was setting out to explore in this. And the fact that Charlotte began to want to occupy Morgan's body at least as much as Morgan did, really set that up. And it just, you know, a lot of ways it kind of wrote itself.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Introducing the new Starbucks Pairings menu, where you can get a tall brewed coffee or tea, hot or iced, paired with a croissant starting at $5, or with a breakfast sandwich starting at $6. Because at Starbucks, we know that some things are better together. Limited time offer at participating stores. Restrictions apply. Visit starbucks.com/pairings to learn more.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Now, you had mentioned previously that you read science a lot, and that kind of helped you in terms of some of your other books. Did you do any research in terms of on trauma or institutionalization or anything, just to kind of really bring that part of the story to life?
I did. I wanted the flavor of the treatments and the therapies that these women were undergoing at Hollyhock House to be primarily that of the 1950s. But I was mixing eras a little bit. There's some treatments that are solidly footed in the 1800s, but a lot of them are straight out of the 1950s. And for that, I found the book Mad Wives by Carol Warren to be extremely educational. That was actually a scientific study that was a survey of, I think, 15 or 20 women and how they were treated in the 1950s, full with interviews and, you know, biographies and all of this. And that was extremely educational to kind of see it in real time, so to speak, to see how these women were treated, paying attention to their interviews, the doctor, what the doctor said and all this. And to also understand that there's a long history in psychology or psychiatry of invented maladies that we then assign to women so we can treat them or control them or whatever. And that was extremely educational. For The Redemption of Morgan Bright, there's a psychological diagnosis called domestic psychosis. Now, that doesn't actually exist, but neither did hysteria. And so I took a lot of the past and I pushed it forward for a lot of reasons, a lot of social reasons that are happening now. And primarily that was Carol Warren's book. And then also I watched a lot of interviews. There are publicly accessible interviews from the 1940s and 50s of female psychological patients being interviewed and talked to by their treaters, their, you know, doctors and so forth. And those are just, man, you go, what were they doing? What were they trying to do with these women? That's some of the saddest stuff you'll ever watch, because mostly what I saw was resignation, because these women were powerless. And there was just a lot of, you know, a doctor saying this and this and this and this and this, and the women saying, sure, whatever. And so you get a diagnosis that a doctor basically asked leading questions to get. So it was primarily Carol Warren's book, and then a lot of interviews, and then a lot of, you know, people love asylums. So the internet is full to the gills of websites, historical websites on different asylums throughout the world, the United States. And I definitely did some deep dives on those to learn about the different treatments, the devices, and just what was done to people so I could either say, okay, here's the foundation for this place, what it had done in the past. And can I invent anything that was worse than was already done for the sake of the story? So yeah, it was a lot of that type of stuff.
You and I both love movies, love TV. And I know, you know, you've had interest in some of your work. Do you, in your mind, when you write something like Redemption of Morgan Bright, that is very visual, you know, you can feel everything around, you know, you do a great job of painting a picture, the characters are vibrant. In your mind, are you seeing things almost like they are on the big screen, or that you can feel them? Not necessarily like you're going, oh, this is a 6-episode limited series or something, but do you almost think in scenes as you're writing?
Absolutely. I don't think any other way. I see it all in my imagination. And, you know, I'm a visual artist too, and that's probably why I see things in terms of the visual impact. But there's nothing I love more than, man, just a bold, shocking, unusual, discordant image. And if I can put that into a horror story, then I'm gonna. And I tried to do that repeatedly in The Redemption of Morgan Bright. But yeah, I definitely see it play out as a scene. I see things, you know, as if it was on the screen. And I think that that has been good because it keeps my pacing pretty good. Because since I'm watching it on the screen of my own mind, after a couple paragraphs, if something's not working, I'm like, well, I'm bored. I'm checking my phone, you know? And so that's a good check on making sure my pacing is doing the right thing, doing what it needs to do in the story.
This is your third book. Is there anything that you learned in the first two, Stringers and The Phlebotomist? Is there anything you learned in those first two that you took into the third book and it really kind of helped you out?
That's a great question. And I haven't been asked that question before. And I think what it gave me was confidence, because The Phlebotomist, which is my debut, is a pretty, it's a little bit twisty. It's got a neat conceit, but it's a pretty straight ahead science fiction / horror adjacent adventure. Stringers is much more audacious. It's very layered. It's very, it examines the nature of consciousness and the universe itself and makes a lot of dick jokes along the way. But it's very audacious. And I think the fact that, you know, I got both those books out and they did well enough to earn out. When I sat down to write The Redemption of Morgan Bright, I think I knew I wanted to take another big swing. And I think those two previous books gave me the confidence to try to do that. I don't know that I never consciously was like, am I ready for this? But I think that if I hadn't done the other books first, and this had been my first book, it would have been very different. And probably, certainly not not as refined as this one was in a lot of ways, just because you continue to get better as a writer as you continue to write. But yeah, I think I had the confidence to push through the difficult stages to get it to where it needed to go, because it did have some stages where I was like, this is terrible, this sucks. I mean, that happens a lot with writing, where it goes through an ugly phase, and so does painting, for that matter. You always have to remember that ugly is just the phase that it's in, and you're going to pull out of it. And I had the confidence, because of those first two books, to know that I would get it out of that messy phase and get it to where it needed to go. So I think that's the answer, is some confidence.
Now that you're out there, you're doing all the book signings, this is probably your 100th podcast talking about the book. What is the thing that's kind of surprised you the most about, you know, now kind of really being, you know, being out of the courtroom for the most part and being an author?
I think what's surprised me is that I really, really love being around other horror writers and horror readers. I always, in the practice of law, I was fortunate. For the most part, I always loved the people I was working with. We had a singular goal, and there was a lot of selfless people I worked with, which, you know, coming from a lawyer, that's saying a lot. But I never wanted to go hang out in a room of lawyers ever. And there's lots of lawyers who live for that. I mean, to me, that's my idea of hell, is going and hanging out in a room of lawyers. When I started to sort of be introduced into the horror community and the writing community at large, but, you know, I'm spending a lot of time in the horror community now, I was like, this is it. These are my people. I love these people. And there's no small talk. There's no, you know, bullshitting. It's just, you jump right in. It's like you just know these people or have known them. And so I just love that. I cherish it.
What advice do you have to somebody who's like, I know I got a novel in me, or I know I got a book in me, but I don't know the first step, or I'm scared to take that first step. What advice do you have to somebody who wants to write a book, but might not know how to get started?
That's such a great question, because of course I have friends that say that. I meet people who say that. You know, this last weekend I was signing books at a Barnes & Noble and someone asked me that question. And the answer I give is have a fair appreciation that it doesn't come quickly and it may never come. And so if you want to do it, you have to do it because you enjoy the creative process. That's the first thing. The second thing is don't set false goals for yourself. Don't put pressure on yourself that you don't need. So if you're someone who says, I've always wanted to write a book, I don't even know about what, you know, maybe it's about my life. Fine. Maybe it's a fictional story. Maybe I want to tell a fictional story. Then sit down at the computer and start writing. Now it's easier said than done, right? And my suggestion for getting started is you do not need an outline. You don't even need an idea. When your mind is geared toward something, if you're thinking about, and anybody who has any job whatsoever, if you're always thinking about those things at your job, your mind is gonna hit you with that stuff, whether you like it or not, right? You're laying on the pillow at night, you're thinking about work. You're not trying to think about work, but you are, because you're calibrated to that. It is absolutely possible to calibrate yourself to writing. You just have to start thinking about it. And so my advice is to sit down at a computer screen. Let's say you want to write some fiction and just start writing about anything. And I think the easiest way to jump in is with dialogue, because dialogue is dynamic. If you just sit down with two characters, put them in a cafe, sitting across from each other, and just have them start ordering what they want to eat, ordering a drink, and having casual conversation. And you would be surprised at how easy it is for that to bear fruit. Because it's not just you creating something from whole cloth. You've now set two characters in motion. And whether you like it or not, they're now on trajectories. And as long as you follow that trajectory, something is going to come of it. Maybe it's just a short story. Maybe it takes on a little bit of meat and you realize that there's a conceit here that is kind of interesting. You know, I told a fellow at this weekend at a Barnes & Noble, he was asking me a question about this. And I was like, you know, if you think for just a little bit about what would be an interesting scenario, let's say, you know, somebody's out for a walk and they walk by the fire station and there's a fireman outside and the person on the walk stops and says hi and starts asking about what it takes to be a fireman. And then you learn later that the person who is asking is an arsonist, you know, and maybe the concept of fireman arsonist, well, that's interesting, right? And if you juxtapose things like that, an arsonist fireman, there's a lot of meat on the bone there. But for someone who's just starting, I would say start a dialogue between two characters. Don't worry about quotation marks. Don't worry about commas or anything. Just have each of them have a line and just start talking. Because we all know how dialogue works. We all have conversations every day. And so that's one of those rules. You already know that. And so my advice is start there. Don't put any pressure on yourself. And then you have to read. You got to read in the genre that you want to write in, and then you need to read outside of it. Everybody says that. That's not an original Chris thought at all. Everybody says that. And it's true.
All right. Well, what is your kind of next challenge? I mean, obviously you're going to keep writing. Do you want to do sci-fi? You want to keep down the horror path? I know you're always writing short stories. What else? What can we expect next?
I think I was always going to end up writing horror. It's funny because even though I started with my first novel is dystopian, science fiction, even though it's got some horror elements. Stringer's was pure space opera science fiction. And then Morgan Bright, I'll add, The Blue is this horror novel. All my short fiction really was always horror, which is interesting. And I think that's because I have certain beliefs about human nature. So I kind of view human nature through a fairly dark lens, which is, I think, the appropriate lens most of the time. I think I was always going to write horror. And so I'm still, my feet are planted firmly in the horror realm right now. I have written another horror novel that is out on submission right now with my agent. So we're trying to sell that one right now. And I'm 100-something pages into yet another horror novel. And I've got a few short stories that are coming out this year that are horror. And then I've written a horror novella, which is, you know, 150 pages or whatever. So it's a slightly shorter one. And that one is getting looked at by some indie publishers. So yeah, I've got a lot going on and nothing. It's crazy how it works, right? Like, I mean, you know, working on your side of it, it's like, I've got so many irons and so many fires. And yet, like, I just had a book come out, but what else is going to come out? I mean, who the hell knows? You know, I mean, but you just got to keep casting the line out there, and you're bound to get bites if you do it enough.
Why don't you let everybody know where they can find not just Redemption of Morgan Bright, but where they can find all of your stuff so they can read everything.
Sure. Thanks. Well, The Redemption of Morgan Bright should be in your favorite bookstore. If it's not, they'll order it for you, but it's everywhere. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and most indie bookstores. And as for me, my website is chrispanatier.com. I am not shy about being found on the internet. I'm also on Twitter at chrisjpanatier, Instagram at chrispanatier. And for those wondering, Panettiere is like French for bread box maker, I think.
Interesting.
So yeah, I'm pretty easy to find.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't know that. All right, my friend. Well, thank you for joining me. Thank you for doing the podcast. I really appreciate it. And congratulations again on the book.
Thanks so much, Steve. I really appreciate being on.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s. 1975, to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Introducing the new Starbucks Pairings menu, where you can get a tall brewed coffee or tea, hot or iced, paired with a croissant starting at $5, or with a breakfast sandwich starting at $6. Because at Starbucks, we know that some things are better together. Limited time offer at participating stores. Restrictions apply. Visit starbucks.com/pairings to learn more.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Okay, next up, we have my interview with award-winning filmmaker Sasha Jenkins, who I've known for 15 years. Sasha has directed some incredible documentaries and docuseries, including Fresh Dressed, Wu-Tang Clan of Mics and Men, Bitchin', The Sound and Fury of Rick James, and Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues. Today, we're chopping it up about his Showtime and Paramount Plus film, Up in the Biz, which chronicles the life and career of hip-hop legend Biz Markie, sometimes referred to as the Clown Prince of hip-hop. The Biz Markie 1989 single, Just a Friend, became a top 40 hit in several countries and was named 100th on VH1's list of the 100 greatest hip-hop songs of all time in 2008. Just a Friend, among several other songs, solidified Biz Markie's place in hip-hop history. Sasha, as always, does a fantastic job telling this story, so you really need to check this film out. Hope you guys like the interview. Welcome back to the podcast, Mr. Sasha Jenkins, the documentary, All Up in the Biz, about the one and only Biz Markie. Sasha, congratulations. I loved the documentary. What made you want to do a doc on Biz Markie?
Well, when Biz was alive, he reached out to me about doing a doc. He was ready to tell his story. And I just thought he was such a fascinating guy. And I tried and tried while he was alive. I had a deck, had a way to go to make the film. And I had no luck. But eventually, after his death, Mass Appeal had a program with Showtime called Hip Hop 50, where they were curating and producing lots of hip hop related programming for the 50th anniversary of hip hop this year, 2023, August 11th. So Vinnie Malhotra, who was the exec there, who I've done a lot of work with, finally greenlit the project, and he's no longer there, but Biz Markie is, and here we are.
How do you feel like Biz Markie fits in when you look at the legacy of Biz and how he fits into that 50 years of hip hop?
Well, he was essentially the personification of hip-hop, the hip-hop distilled in its purest form in an individual. It's almost like, honestly, hip-hop's Jesus. He was there for so much. He influenced so many people. He encouraged in the way Jesus would, Rakim and Big Daddy Kane. I mean, those two guys shed tears talking about Biz, and, you know, I asked them, well, you know, where do you think you would be if he didn't meet him? And they both were like, I don't know where I would have been if I didn't meet this guy. So he had his hand in so many things early on. He was really a major part of the formation of the establishment of hip hop. His sense of humor, you know, he didn't take himself too seriously. He had a good time with it. And that's what I also enjoyed. The hip hop of my era was fun also. I mean, you had gangsters and tough guys. We had people like Biz Markie who were about fun. And it reminds me of just the simple times that we had as kids in New York City. So it was a great privilege to be able to tell his story.
You know, you mentioned he has passed away, but you manage in the documentary to really provide that fun that he had, that kind of lovable character who he was. Was it tough to kind of have that ability because people miss him? You know, you interview his wife, you interview a lot of people who were close to him. Was that something you kept in mind throughout, that you didn't want this to kind of be a sad documentary? You wanted this to be upbeat because of who he was as a human being.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a guy, when people think about Biz Markie, they think about happiness and fun and like a guy who was never angry, a guy who easily could have been bitter and resentful because no one expected anything from him. People made fun of him, but he's kept an upbeat demeanor. I felt that was really inspiring. So I wanted to find a way to pay tribute and honor that while also tell a story. And, you know, you can't get like a human being to be Biz Markie. It's just weird. So he collected toys. One of his more famous videos, or a video that he was attached to, Me and the Biz, you learn about that story in the film, but Master Ace used a Biz puppet to replace Biz because he couldn't make the video shoot. And so to me, it all made sense. I mean, the guy collects Barbie dolls. He's on Yo Gabba Gabba. He, you know, he's just a big, goofy guy. And I thought the puppet would be a good idea. Don't ask me why, but a voice told me, go with puppets. A voice also told me to ask his wife to be a part of it and reenact those scenes, which, you know, it's not a traditional request, but she really just leaned into it and did a phenomenal job. And some people feel a way about her doing that, but I think she understood, the reason why she did it was she knew that it was something that he probably would have wanted. And she, you know, did a great job honoring her husband.
For the audience, like, you really have to watch the documentary, because I applaud you, Sasha. Just like every film that you do, you take a chance in some way so that everybody knows that it's your documentary, and using the puppet, you're immediately going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Was that something that kind of organically just came up as you started filming? Was it an idea that you got talking to his wife? How did that idea of using a puppet version of Bismarcky, how did that come about?
Well, the actual puppet, Ego Trip Magazine, which is a magazine I used to publish, we got our hands on the actual puppet. So there's a guy, the puppet is actually in a duffel bag in a basement in Harlem right now. And I wanted to borrow it for the shoot, but the warden of the puppet refused because he said it's just in poor shape. And I said, well, I'll get you a car, drive you to set. You can be the only one handling the puppet. You can take the puppet out of the bag and put it back. I just want to show Master Ace the puppet. He didn't want to do it. So I thought about what would be a good sort of way to represent that puppet that I couldn't get, and something that would be true to Biz. And so a friend of mine worked on Crank Anchors for years. And obviously, if you know Crank Anchors, you know they have real legitimate puppets. So he put me in touch with a puppet master, and he made the puppet and came up to New York and operated the puppet. And I don't know, man, sometimes the voices in my head tell me to do things. And I think we all have voices in our heads. And the voice in my head told me to get a puppet, and the voice told me to get his wife to play herself in the film. And it is a chance, and some people don't like it, but I think most people get it and understand why I did it. So, you know, when you have your chance at bat, you got to try to come as original as you can, so you can, there's so many choices, so many platforms, so many networks, so many things that people can choose to watch. You want to make something that people will, you know, won't be distracted by other things and really pay attention to what you're doing. Because these days, once the thing comes out, it's hot for about 2 weeks and then it just disappears into the ether because there's so much stuff out there. So I wanted to take a swing and, you know, also show people that I'm making my way towards narrative filmmaking. And so, and, you know, I've done a million docs. It gets boring just having people sit there and talk about somebody who's dead. So I wanted to make it more interactive, I guess.
You know, now you've done a handful of documentaries about fantastic musical artists, Wu-Tang Clan, Rick James, Louis Armstrong, Biz. You, as you said, like, you know, this is becoming kind of one of those genres that is so prevalent now. You're right. It can be easy to just go, okay, yeah, I missed this one. I saw that one. How much pressure do you have now when you're talking to their family, the wife, you know, their friends, other artists, that it's like, okay, I'm telling the definitive story of this particular artist? And creatively, like you said, you've got to go, okay, I can't do the exact same thing that I did with Wu-Tang Clan or I did with Rick James. I got to come up with something different.
Yeah, well, you try to get in with the estate and the people who are closest to him. And I think we did a good job of getting in touch with the right people. It was a properly curated group of people who knew him and loved him, between family members, his widow, friends, other artists. So, you know, you make the rounds, and people understand your intentions. They're like, I'm not trying to make a film that's going to like get him somehow or paint him in a negative light. But I'm also going to make a film that's fair and balanced and gets into the things that he didn't want to talk about. And, you know, all of his friends and family will tell you that, like, he never wanted to talk about family or things that made him feel uncomfortable. So we were able to tackle some of the things that he couldn't tackle himself, or things that he didn't want to tackle. And so when you communicate your idea and the kind of balance that you want to get the right people in there, people usually cooperate. I mean, when I did Rick James, his daughter Ty was extremely collaborative and, you know, let me do my thing. And with RZA, he had a lot of faith in me and just let me do my thing. So I think I try my best to make people understand that I'm very sincere in what I'm doing. I'm a music fan, I'm a musician, I want to make sure that this thing is true to the artist who is here or isn't here.
Do you think that looking at kind of the landscape of hip hop today, will there ever be a character or a rapper who can be as unique, be as colorful as somebody like Biz?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's up to the new generation to decide, to make that decision. I mean, I think that they, from what I can see, these kids, their sphere of influences were way more broad than when I was coming up. And so I think they have a lot of information and culture at their fingertips with the internet and kind of the places they roam these days. But I don't know enough about what's happening now to give you a definitive answer, but my semi-definitive answer is I believe that it's up to this generation, but I think in many ways Biz didn't take himself so seriously. And I feel like a lot of kids today don't necessarily take themselves so seriously. That's not to say that they're not serious about their craft. I think they are, but I think like they're a bit less intense with how they want to present themselves and how they express themselves. So I would think that there would be someone would emerge who has Biz's sort of acumen, his pedigree.
What was the biggest surprise for you? I mean, obviously you knew him, but what surprised you as you did your research, as you did all these interviews as part of this documentary about Biz Markie?
Well, I didn't know he was homeless for a while, living under a bridge in Long Island with his dad. That I did not know. I didn't know that his mom dropped dead right in front of him. And so he had a lot of trauma. And when you consider all the trauma he had, his ability to overcome all of that and to stay focused on his goal, which was to be a successful artist, to be in hip hop somehow, to make a living, to travel the world. His determination, I think, is really inspirational. And I think it's the kind of thing that crosses over to people, places, and things universally. His determination is an inspiration for anybody. So I had no idea how much he overcame to become who he became. And that was just super interesting for me.
I felt kind of like, as I watched, you know, that this was a love story in a lot of different ways, his love of hip hop, his love of music, his love of just being around people. And then obviously falling in love with his wife and his wife, you know, being there for him all the way to the very end. Was that something do you agree with that? And was that something you were trying to bring out in the film?
I do agree with that. I think I wanted people to know that Biz, while he was sick, for a year fighting for his life, he wasn't by himself. And in the real world, there's a lot of people who have resentment towards his wife because they didn't have the opportunity to visit him. But the truth of the matter is, it was COVID. Like, you couldn't visit him. The one person who could was his wife, and she was there by his side. And I think understanding that relationship is important to understanding who Biz was. You know, he was a stepdad. He was a husband. He loved being a husband and a stepdad. And I think understanding that is an important part of understanding who he was as an artist and beyond.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Introducing the new Starbucks Pairings menu, where you can get a tall brewed coffee or tea, hot or iced, paired with a croissant starting at $5, or with a breakfast sandwich starting at $6. Because at Starbucks, we know that some things are better together. Limited time offer at participating stores. Restrictions apply. Visit starbucks.com/pairings to learn more.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
What do you feel like is Biz's legacy? What do you feel like? How do you feel like we should look at him in the kind of scope of hip-hop?
Well, I think his big hit, Just a Friend, was an early crossover hit for hip-hop, meaning at a time where hip-hop wasn't everywhere in the mainstream, he was able to make a song that connected with everybody. And to me, that foreshadowed where hip-hop was going. He, you know, sang off-key. So many people didn't believe in the song. So many people didn't believe in him, but he pushed forward. And that song wound up becoming a huge hit. But again, if you don't know Biz Markie, but someone says, have you heard this song? And he plays three bars of You Got, you know, Just a Friend. Everybody knows that song. So in his own way, he contributed to the mainstreaming of hip hop with the level of you could be mainstream in hip hop, but remain authentic. You could be, you can cross over from hip hop to the pop world, but you can do it while remaining authentic to yourself. And I think that Biz knew who he was at an early age and was true to himself the whole time, which is also really inspiring.
All Up in the Biz is on Showtime, which is now Paramount Plus with Showtime. How do you feel about kind of this changing landscape of documentaries?
Well, I always said that I'll always have a gig because computers or robots can't do what I do. But we're learning that they can, or people believe that they can. So at this point, I'm just trying to find a way to maintain my voice, because the only thing that, the only value that I provide is whatever my unique view is on the subjects that I get to tell stories about. So I'm really focused. My way of dealing with it is sort of being able to make things that, like you said earlier, that stand out, that are definitively me, because that's the value. Other than that, if you can't really do something that's definitive or unique to who you are, it's going to get harder and harder to work. And who knows, maybe I'll only have another 6 years based on the way this AI thing is going. But you got to try to be unique and original, which is one of the principles of hip hop. You never want to copy other people. And, you know, it's all been done. I'm sure there are plenty of things that I've copied from other people, but it's the combination of things that you copy that you put together that makes your own vocabulary, that makes you stand out. And so what's going to happen, I have no idea, man. There's a million and one platforms, a million and one mergers, a million and one like people getting fired, a million and one people trying to figure out what's going to happen. I just got to keep going. I can't really think too much about it, but I'm lucky right now. You know, I'm still getting work. So I'm very thankful that I'm able to maintain a fruitful living. I have this film about Ed Sullivan that's coming sometime soon, that's completed. So it's all, you know, a calling card that will hopefully lead to the next gig. I got to think of it in very simple terms, because if I try to get too philosophical or too deep with it, it's going to drive me nuts.
We don't want that.
I don't get a week off for mental health breaks like people at Nike do. So
that's true. That's very true. So you have Ed Sullivan coming up. You've done Louis Armstrong, Biz, Wu-Tang, Rick James. Do you enjoy digging into a person or a few people's lives like that? Or do you kind of, are you looking forward to maybe taking on a subject matter, or deep dive into a scandal or, you know, a scam or something? What, you know, do you love this kind of ability to take an artist's life or somebody's life and really tell their definitive story?
Well, I love music. I think through music, there's so many things that you can unpack just through an artist's, like a song is like a movie in and of itself. And there's so much information inside of a song that you can unpack that leads to understanding the individual who created it. So as a musician myself, I love surrounding myself with music any chance I can get. But I did a film called Burn Motherfucker Burn about the so-called riots of Los Angeles. I'm open to tackling topics and getting into, you know, larger conversations about the world at large. But right now it seems like I've got a rhythm with these music docs, so I'm not going to upset the apple cart too much, but I'm open to the possibilities of other things coming my way.
Some people may not know that you do play guitar in a band. As a musician, how much does that come into play when you are a filmmaker on a doc about a famous singer or famous musical artist?
Well, I think if you have performed before, you have an understanding of what the artist may have been thinking or what they've experienced. I mean, obviously, I'm not Rick James, but I've been on stage in front of a couple hundred people before. And I know what it's like to do press. I know what it's like to put out a record. And, you know, in these days, like, rock and roll isn't like the big thing. It's funny, like, Slash is doing an album about blues, like a blues album, a blues solo album. I heard an interview with him where he's talking about, the interviewer was like, well, blues is essentially dead. Now, do you think you're bringing it to life? He's like, I love the blues. It's always there. But I'm thinking to myself, like, rock and roll is pretty dead right now. I mean, it's not dead for Guns N' Roses because they're touring and they're getting paid. And there's always going to be room for a couple of marquee rock bands. But I think rock right now, like, people, kids don't really care. So for me, having the ability to be around music and musicians is always great. And I think from my experiences, I have an understanding that I can bring to the table that might help bring out questions I might ask that someone else might not ask, or an understanding in terms of the editing or things we're putting together to help tell the story. So I think with music docs, I think I'm going to add an advantage.
The presence of YouTube, the presence of TikTok, Netflix. Right now, if you're under 30, right, you're not watching Showtime. You're not watching broadcast media. You're not really even watching Peacock or, you know, in a lot of times, Discovery. So how do you, you're a father, you have a younger son. How do you kind of approach this new world of digital? Do you look at the YouTubes of the world? Do you look at TikTok as a place that you can kind of maybe get some of your content?
Right. Yeah. I mean, personally, I'm on YouTube every day. I find it to be a great resource for, if I'm doing a project, you know, looking for interviews with an artist or interesting things that are related to an artist. It's limitless. And I realized, you know, that people love memes and love short things. And I'm not at a place where I'm trying to make that kind of content, but that time may come. Or maybe there'll just be a time where there'll be a few people who have the opportunity to make longer form things. And I'm hopefully going to make that cut. But it's just a new way to think these days, man. My son, like, he has no idea what the hell ABC is. I think he'll know the show Black-ish. But I don't think he saw it on ABC. I think he saw it on Hulu. So he'll know what Hulu is, but he has no idea what ABC is. You know, he knows what TikTok is. He knows what Instagram is. He knows what Twitter is. And that's what's interesting. I mean, these kids spend most of their lives, and he knows Netflix, of course, and Hulu. So there are things that he watches on Netflix and Hulu sometimes. But their world is so different from ours, from mine growing up. And I can't imagine what it would be like if the ideas that I had when I was young doing my own magazines, if I had access to something as powerful as the internet, what I would have done. But I also realized that I wouldn't have been special. When I was doing what I was doing, there were only a handful of people doing these magazines. Now, with the internet, it's like there's a million kids in their bedroom somewhere in Idaho writing about hip hop or whatever. And so I probably wouldn't have stood out. So for my time, I took advantage of my time, but I don't imagine how these kids are going to get through now.
It's interesting you say that your son has seen Black-ish, but he doesn't know what ABC is. Cause I had this conversation with a friend the other day that, you know, Suits has become this phenomenon on NBC, on Netflix, when, you know, it was successful on USA, but if you're young, you have no idea what USA Network is. Do you feel like, at the end of the day, good content will find its way to people and it will still get watched? So no matter whether you're making documentaries or dramas or sitcoms, eventually it will find its way to a platform and people will find it.
I mean, that's the hope. But I think there's also lots of crappy content out there that people think is good. I don't know if my standards are high or what, but it's, you know, I think there's so much that goes into it. It's not just making something good. You need promotion, right? I mean, like, promotion is super important. So you can have the greatest thing in the world, but if it's not promoted right, like, who knows what happens? It just disappears. I mean, this Louis Armstrong film that I did, it was with Apple and Imagine Entertainment. When the two of those people get together, those two entities, this is power. It's high powered. Like, I never had so much support in my life in terms of, you know, travel and like screenings and doing things to get the film considered for various awards. I mean, they just really pulled out all the stops. And I was very impressed by that. But it's not always going to be like that. So you just hope that whatever it is that you're making, that there's some kind of promotion going towards it and that people will eventually connect with it. But again, there are so many choices out there for people to spend their time and money on. You've really got to come with something original, or it's like you just keep making mundane shit that mundane people will watch, which is most people, but who knows, man? It's very, this whole shit is just, who knows? I'm just rolling with it.
That's good advice for all of us. Just roll with it.
Nothing you can do.
Exactly.
I mean, we had a sweet deal at Showtime, but I'm working with a more network, you know, not just cable, but, you know, an unnamed network. And the amount of red tape is just staggering. I felt like, looking back at my deal at Showtime, like, that was like public access. Like, they were great. They were supportive, and they didn't step on your toes, and they let you do what you wanted to do. But when you go to mainstream, you know, television, that shit's not easy. That shit's hard. It's a full-time job managing it.
You know, we mentioned the younger generation, right? Somebody who's making content on YouTube or TikTok, right? Where right now, studies show if you're under 30, you are watching more YouTube, more TikTok than any other platform. No red tape. If you want to make content on YouTube, you make it, it goes out to the world. TikTok, you make it, it goes out to the world. Do you feel like the increased level of red tape for folks like yourself or me, or really anybody who's trying to make something for Netflix or Hulu or any place that is a commercial platform, that increased level of, you know, legal paperwork, making a deal, agents, managers, that is a detriment to the fact that big tech is expanding their role in entertainment?
Yeah, I mean, it's new generation has to define which way we're going. And will the old guys pay attention? I have no idea, but at some point they're going to have no choice. I mean, again, my kid is on all the platforms you mentioned. He has no idea what ABC is. He knows Netflix and he knows Hulu, and that's about it. People are going to have to get creative in terms of how they're working. And I think this is just where the game is right now. If you want to be in the game, you just have to do more work. You have to be more due diligence. It's going to cost you more money because the contracts are going to be more expensive, you know, more detailed, and that's money that you've got to spend. And networks and platforms are tight with their wallets and their purses. And because they're tighter with their wallets and purses, they want you to jump through many more hoops to get that money. So it's going to have to be adjustment.
All right. So tell everybody where they can watch All Up in the Biz. It's a fantastic documentary. Where can they find it?
You can find All Up in the Biz on Paramount Plus with Showtime, apparently. On demand, anytime you want to watch it.
Fantastic. All right, man. Thank you so much for doing the podcast. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Steve Berkowitz. Thank you so much.
Okay, before I go, I'm going to complain a little bit, just a little bit, about a recent documentary that I saw. It's the Hulu doc, Bratz. I had super high hopes for this film, which is directed by Andrew McCarthy, about the Brat Pack, the legendary group of young actors who came of age in the 1980s. This Brat Pack includes Andrew McCarthy, Judd Nelson, Emilio Estevez, Molly Ringwald, Rob Lowe, Demi Moore, Ali Sheedy, and potentially a few others. It's debatable. Anyway, McCarthy and his director of photography made a very stylistic choice to show basically tons of camera operators and sound mixers and crew, more so than I've ever seen before in a film. I mean, you literally cannot go 5 minutes in the dock without a camera op or a sound mixer popping into the frame. You see elbows, you see literally operators just standing there, you know, shooting for seconds at a time, sometimes 20, 30 seconds, you'll just see them in the frame. It's mind-boggling. I could not believe it, and it is distracting. And look, my humble opinion, I'm just one dude, I found it kind of lazy. And honestly, I was so excited to see this film because I kind of, you know, that was kind of my childhood. You know, I loved Breakfast Club. I loved Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 16 Candles, a lot of those movies. And so it was really disappointing. So I don't recommend it, but if you want to just see the kind of ridiculousness of seeing camera operators and sound mixers in the shot, watch 10 to 15 minutes of Bratz. Okay, that's going to do it for another episode of No Script, No Problem. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, download, and rate it with 5 stars. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can also find it on Bleav.com and at Bleav Podcast. Follow me on Twitter at Steve Berkowitz and on Threads or Instagram at Steve M. Berkowitz. Send any questions you have to noscriptnoproblempodcast@gmail.com. If you're interested in advertising on the show, please contact Bleav at Bleav.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Berkowitz for No Script, No Problem.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie, and fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.